Even having like terms such as rejection sensitivity or time blindness or hyperfixation helped me so much, because those were things that I learned about like surprisingly recently, considering what I do for a living. And so even having those names destigmatizes, you know, the symptoms that you're experiencing or the experiences you're having. And I mean, I think even just like getting a diagnosis in general can be so validating in that way, because it's like, oh, I finally understand why my brain is doing what it's doing, or why I process things in this certain way, and it doesn't appear that other people struggle with this the way I do. And it's that, again, that perceived defectiveness of like, what is happening with me, or what is wrong with me that I can't, quote unquote, get it together. And so once you finally understand what's happening, then you feel that relief of just like, oh my gosh, first of all, I'm not the only person who struggles with this, but also this isn't something I have to feel any shame about. This is just how my brain is.
You're listening to the Future ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Grace Coulmer, and welcome to this week's episode. I am so glad you're here. It has been a big week. Last week, I launched the podcast officially, which was very exciting and also very nerve-wracking. But you guys have been really beautiful, and so many of you have sent me words of encouragement, little comments, DMs, and email notes. So just know that I am so grateful for all of the support. It really does mean the world to me and really invigorates me to keep on going and keep on innovating and creating spaces to discuss what's next in the space for neurodivergence and how we can be really shaping the future of ADHD together. In today's episode, I have an incredible conversation with Laura Scrow, who is a licensed therapist from California. And I can't wait to get into it. It is such a helpful, practical, and inspiring conversation. And it's perfect if you're somebody who is wondering whether you've got ADHD and whether to get diagnosed, or maybe you're recently diagnosed later in life and trying to make sense of everything. And maybe you're dealing with the layers, the complexity, the emotions, the frustrations, the regret. This episode is for you. And I particularly want to mention and underline and really empathize with that experience of frustration that I'm pretty sure everyone feels with ADHD at least once, if not many times. I know I have. And it's that feeling of whipping yourself up into a spiral or a shame spiral, or having the inner self-critic come out and berate you, and just that feeling of not wanting to be inside your own brain anymore, of wanting to shut it all off, of feeling like it's just constantly talking at you, it's moving so quickly, there's so much happening and you just can't keep up. And I just want to create space today to really, really witness that and let you know that I see you, because I've been through it and I know what it's like to feel frustrated, to feel alone, to feel like no matter what people tell you, what advice you hear, what articles you listen to, what podcasts you listen to, nothing seems to land and nothing seems to stick. And maybe that you'll never, ever, ever be able to move through your struggles. And I think the very first step is to just acknowledge that there are difficulties and struggles, and that when we try and push those away, when we try and be positive all the time, that can create this unrealistic echo chamber of pressure, and that doesn't really get us anywhere, because then we just feel like failures and that activates that shame spiral. So if you're feeling like this today, if you're just feeling like, oh, you know, another episode, another podcast that's going to be full of tips that I won't be able to implement because I'm busy, I have a life to lead, I have maybe children to support, I have, you know, a really stressful job, or the house is always messy, just know that I see you, and I really want to witness you and let you know that your struggle is real and that it's okay to feel like it's all too much. You make sense. Your frustrations make sense. And even though your brain feels like it's exploding, it does make sense. You don't have to change. You don't have to be any different. Just allowing yourself to really feel what you need to feel and let it go and release that pent-up frustration is so important, because I think that it really blocks us from ever being able to move past that and start to explore what might release some of this tension, what might create some ease for me. So if that's you right now, please know that you're seen and supported by this village, by this community. We all get it. And if you can find somebody to talk with about it that isn't going to try and fix things straight away, please do that. And know that when you're ready, the next steps will be here for you. But really empathizing with yourself and allowing yourself some compassion and really acknowledging how hard it can be is such a crucial first step before we rush into how can I help? How can I make things better? And when we give ourselves that self-compassion, everything eases, because we hold up so much tension when we're trying to prove to the world how hard things are. And so when someone comes along and validates that for you and goes, yeah, it's hard, you don't have to convince me, I believe you, instantly we soften. And when we allow that softness to sort of take hold and to really resonate in our bodies, that's when we might start to feel like, what can I do then? Like, if it is hard, surely there's something that can be done. And the good news is that there is. And out of that place of acknowledgement, you can definitely start to find people that can help, find free resources that can help. This podcast is here to do that for you. And just know that we are rooting for you, and we know that you'll be able to bring yourself through this, because you've brought yourself through everything already in your life. You've made it here. You're strong. Okay, pep talk over. I cannot wait for you to hear this episode, for you to meet Laura Scrow. She is an absolute gem, and this episode is a treat. Without further ado, I'm going to take you to my conversation with Laura Scrow right after this fancy intro. Life with an ADHD brain can be a wild ride, swinging between intense obsessions and hyperfocus to exhaustion and overwhelm. And sometimes these pendulum swings can feel very lonely in a world that doesn't truly understand neurodiversity. But what if our daydreaming, impulsivity, and fierce obsessions all make complete sense? What if we're not flawed or disordered, but rather living in a fast-paced world that wasn't designed for our brilliant ADHD brains? Believe me, I know firsthand that living with ADHD isn't easy, and we'll definitely talk about those challenges here too. But after decades focusing on the deficiencies, it's time for a shift. Join me as we explore the latest ADHD research and take a deep dive into topics like unconscious limiting beliefs, habits and productivity, mindset, self-care, and nervous system nourishment. I'll also chat to a range of neurodivergent guests so we can challenge the status quo, change the conversation, and shape the future of ADHD together. Hello, Laura. Welcome to the podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you here, and I am so looking forward to our conversation today.
Hi, Grace. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Amazing. Okay, so to kick things off, tell us a bit about yourself and your work as a therapist and your journey with discovering that you have ADHD.
Sure. So my name is Laura Scrow. I'm a licensed psychotherapist in Los Angeles, California, in the United States. And I am a late bloomer with my ADHD journey, like I think so many of us are finding that we are, right? Where I didn't realize until I hit about 30 years old that this was something that I really was struggling with and didn't really know much about, and didn't even really come up too much in my work prior to this. And now that I sort of have unlocked this piece of my brain, it all is making sense. And so it's been a really, really cool, interesting, confusing, difficult, fun, all of the things kind of a journey to just realize how this is impacting me, how this is playing into my work, and then of course realizing how I can support clients too who might be showing up with similar presentations.
Wow, that sounds like quite the journey. And were there any specific moments when you realized hey, I might have ADHD.
Yeah, well, for so long, my perception of ADHD has been like what I think so many folks think of is, you know, the young boy in school who's super hyperactive and can't sit still and maybe struggling academically. And that's sort of, at least over here in the States, that's been a lot of just our understanding of it culturally. And so as I've been growing up, I've always kind of struggled with anxiety myself. That's sort of been my big presentation for my own struggles. And realizing that a lot of the aspects of my high functioning anxiety is like hand in hand with my ADHD symptoms and with my ADHD presentations. And so I would say that after graduate school, once I stopped having a big structure that was kind of done for me and deadlines that had like real high stakes was when I noticed that I started really struggling. And I think the pandemic also really created a space for me to realize that I was struggling to be productive and I was struggling to focus when I thought, oh, I have so much free time. Why am I always thought it was a time thing. And I think that's something that a lot of us kind of have experienced. It's like, oh, if I just had more time, I could do more things. And then when I had all the time in the world and it still wasn't happening, that's when it started to connect the dots for me.
Mm. So was that into your sort of late 20s or what age were you when that started happening?
Yeah, the pandemic was in 2020. So I was in my late 20s then, 27 going on 28, and realizing like, oh, this function that I thought was just really high functioning anxiety or just, you know, maybe just trouble regulating my emotions is actually something that's linked to my difficulty focusing and my difficulty staying productive and even my enthusiasm as part of my personality, I think plays into some of this as well. I'm sure we'll get into kind of how that all looks later. But yeah, so definitely later in life for me.
Mm. And did you have a moment where you, or many moments where you looked back at your past, your childhood, your time in school, and had any regret or any confusion or maybe like an aha moment of that's why I did that or that's why that friendship was difficult or those kind of moments?
Yeah. And this is something I've recently reengaged in therapy for myself as well. I believe all therapists should be in therapy. So I wanted to practice what I preach. And I was realizing that a lot of my, again, just kind of emotional dysregulation or difficulty with perceived rejection and those kinds of things, I always assumed I was just a little moody or that I was just a little over emotional and that I was just too much for people, right? And I just had this big personality. And I think some of that is true, the big personality piece. But I think also like looking back, so much of that was my ADHD, really not understanding it and not seeing how it was playing out. And so I love that this is becoming more of a conversation culturally, because I just get so sad for all the young folks, especially young girls, right? Or young women. And we know that ADHD presents differently in women than it does in men, who aren't being represented in those conversations and who aren't realizing that this is something that they can get relief for way earlier in life, or at least understand it better way earlier in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to just add as well, you mentioned the difference between men and women, and there are probably a lot of traits that cross all genders, but I feel like from my research and my lived experience, and tell me if you feel the same, Laura, like for women, it can often be if you do have the hyperactivity trait and you have the combined ADHD, the hyperactivity can often show up in like in your mind. So like racing thoughts, a lot of anxiety or intensity of your personality, that kind of thing. I find personally I'm not always running up the walls, surprisingly. My 7-year-old boy, he definitely has a bit more of the typical ADHD. He's not diagnosed, but he definitely shows those traits, whereas my hyperactivity is all in my mind. And I think that's a really important point to articulate for women particularly. And do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that makes so much sense. And I know that there's so much comorbidity between ADHD and other, you know, mental health conditions. And so this is just another example of how, you know, someone could be like, well, maybe I'm just really anxious. And not that that's not true, but that can actually really compound your ADHD experience as well. And those things can really play off of each other to make your experience a lot more difficult.
Sounds like there are more layers to uncover and things to tease apart when you have comorbidities at play.
Yeah, most definitely.
Okay, so our paths crossed because you bought my ADHD planner. This is how we originally met, and you loved it. So tell me, as a licensed therapist, What are your thoughts about the planner, and why do you think it's more helpful to ADHD brains than, say, a traditional planner?
Yeah, and Grace, I just have to say this very honestly. I bought not only just your planner, but I bought an iPad so that I could use your planner because I wanted it so much because it spoke to me so much. which I think is maybe a very ADHD thing to do, right? But yeah, because it spoke to me in so many things. I think a big piece of the way that you've crafted your planner is that, like, throughout all of it, you just get to give yourself permission. You get to give yourself permission to use it in the way that it best makes sense for you. So for me, I'm the kind of person where I go through, like, fluctuations of periods with, I'm super plannery and organized and filling out all the boxes and doing all the things. And then I'll go like 2 weeks, not even touching it. And I just love that your planner allows, for permission to do that. There's no, like, blank pages that I have to, like, stare at every day. There's no, you know, I can clear the page and have it be this new thing. So I really love the flexibility of that. And I think the other thing that makes your planner really unique is the educational components to it, and the fact that you've explained sort of why these pages work the way they work. I'm thinking of, like, the DivCon planning page specifically, which has been a game changer too, to just have a space to, like, brain dump that out. I have so many post-its and to-do lists and things everywhere, and so it was just nice to have that space. So I'm even thinking too, like, how in my work, how this could be a resource for folks who are just looking for this this thing that's organized in the way that their brain actually works versus the traditional, like, I always wondered why regular planners, like, didn't work for me. And it wasn't until I saw the layout of how yours is that I realized, like, oh, my brain just doesn't respond in the way that I need it to these other sort of more basic planners.
Yeah. And it makes me also think, as you're talking, like, so much of the planner design is around reducing shame, because I actually didn't really realize I was doing that when I was designing it. But that has been one of the number one pieces of feedback I've received, is people saying, oh, wow, like, I have a completely new self-concept now, because I always thought I was bad at planning and organization. And then I turned that into a negative trait that I had, or something that meant I was worthless, or I wasn't, you know, able to get things done. I wasn't able to be successful. So there's quite a lot of baggage attached to that, just even around organization. And so to give people a new way of seeing themselves through a planner that is based in science, but also has a bunch of structures that are shame-free. I feel like that was something I actually stumbled into just, I guess, through creating something I wanted almost. Like, I just made the planner that I want. Yeah. So do you feel like that's how you saw it too? Like, there was elements of it that really helped you get rid of that guilt, as you said, for staring at pages every day?
Absolutely, because I think there's this theme of, like, what you said, shame, and even, like, a belief of defectiveness, right? Of, like, well, why can't my brain work this way? Or why isn't my brain responding in the way that I feel like it, quote unquote, should? I feel like there's a lot of shoulding on ourselves when we have these kinds of thought processes. And so having, yeah, just this planner that's created in this way where there is none of that, there doesn't need to be any of that, because it's so customizable. And again, you provide the science background for why some of these pages are useful and what the thought process is there, which I think, you know, for so many of us, we respond better when we understand why things are happening, or we understand what the purpose of something is. So I love that element that you added.
And I feel like the curiosity piece for ADHD, I feel like that, to me, in all of my evolution and all the new things I've discovered, that's been almost like the gateway. Like, when I'm frustrated at myself because I am like, why am I doing this? Why is this happening? If I can, like, go online and start, you know, doing a nerdy little hyper-focused deep dive about, well, actually, what does the science say? And what do some of the leading experts who've been researching this for decades say about, you know, rejection sensitivity, or about, you know, time blindness, or whatever the thing might be. And then I'm like, oh, there's an explanation. And that straight away helps reduce that shame.
Yes.
And that confusion, I guess.
Even having, like, terms such as rejection sensitivity or time blindness or hyperfixation helped me so much, because those were things that I learned about, like, surprisingly recently, considering what I do for a living. But I wasn't focused on treating folks with ADHD for a long time. And so even having those names destigmatizes, you know, the symptoms that you're experiencing, or the experiences you're having. And I mean, I think even just, like, getting a diagnosis in general can be so validating in that way, because it's like, oh, I finally understand why my brain is doing what it's doing, or why I process things in this certain way, and it doesn't appear that other people struggle with this the way I do. And it's that, again, that perceived defectiveness of like, what is happening with me, or what is wrong with me that I can't, quote unquote, get it together. And so once you finally understand what's happening, then you feel that relief of just like, oh my gosh, first of all, I'm not the only person who struggles with this, but also this isn't something I have to feel any shame about. This is just how my brain is.
Yes, absolutely. And that leads really well into my next question, which is around diagnosis, and partly around what you feel the role of diagnosis is. And I'd also love to add into that question, as a therapist, you don't diagnose people, is that right? In the States, it's psychiatrists that do that.
I actually do diagnose for something like for something like ADHD. It is best practice though to be diagnosed by a psychiatrist, especially because they can be the gateway to getting medication if that's something that you're wanting. But it is something that I can help clients assess for and diagnose. Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. It's a bit different in Australia. So tell me a little bit about your role in helping people with diagnosis. And do you kind of do a bit of therapy around it too, to help them process their identity shift, I guess?
Yeah. So a big part of my approach, just on a personally, is around like storytelling. So what's the dominant story that has been, you know, your story throughout your life? What has gotten you to this place today that you're coming into my office, and you know, whatever your struggles are? And really, what are the almost like points on a timeline, or what are the experiences you've had that have perpetuated this story? So for a lot of folks maybe who are realizing that they struggle with something like ADHD, or that they're experiencing symptoms that are in line with ADHD, that story might be something like, wow, I'm just too much for people. Or, you know, if I act this way, then people are going to be really like, you know, overwhelmed by me. Or I know part of my own story around this was, why can't I just get my freaking stuff together and like stay focused and organized? I'm trying to like run a business here. Why can't I do this? So a lot of that shame sort of underlying story. And so when folks come in and we sort of tease out that this might be something that is part of their presentation, usually again in conjunction with anxiety or something else that they're coming to me for, maybe they have more knowledge about that thing, or it's more talked about, whatever it is, then we can start to figure out like, what does your brain need, right? Or what do you need? What other storylines can be in existence here besides the storyline around shame and not feeling good enough or feeling too much? And so for a lot of times with folks that come in who either have an ADHD diagnosis or they suspect they might have one, it's a lot of that. So what is this, like, what's the meaning that is being put on this for you? And so I hear a lot that folks like feel relieved to have, again, like a label for something, some sort of scientific backing for why they're experiencing what they're experiencing. And then the other thing that happens too sometimes is a conversation around like, well, why are there words like neurotypical and neurodivergent when really there's just different brains and different styles of processing? And so we have some really cool conversations about that too.
Say more about that. I'd love to hear what you mean by that.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of a situation where I was talking to someone about this, and like this idea of being neurotypical, even in that sort of language, there can be something a little bit stigmatizing about, well, what if I'm not neurotypical, right? What does that mean? Does that mean I'm neuro-other, right? And so I will say that I'm really happy to see, and the person that I was chatting with about this, we were both really happy to see that there's more conversation happening around neurodiversity. And I think that that's actually a really great term for it. But this idea of like being neurotypical or not neurotypical is a little bit more like, I think there's more work we can do, I would say, to destigmatize those kinds of labels. Because as much as there's power in diagnosis, there's power in language in general, and we just want to be careful how we're talking about folks.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I almost, as you're talking, I'm starting to feel like I have for quite a while now felt that some of these labels are almost bridge labels, like they're getting us almost to where we want to be. You know, ADHD as well has the word deficit in it and also disorder in it, and both of those like parts of it. I mean, a lot of people have issues with the term ADHD because it's so limited in how it describes the actual traits of this kind of brain-based difference. And I have wanted to rename it for so long. And actually for my son, who's only 7, we've chosen not to get him diagnosed, you know, yet. And I don't know when we will or if we will, but there is a big kind of stigma attached to ADHD, particularly with young boys. And so instead of talking about his unique brain in those terms, I say that he has a galaxy brain.
A galaxy brain. I love that. I was going to ask you, like, so what would you call it? But I love that so much. And I was noticing the same thing as you were about the word, like, deficit, right? There's something in that that is just so, like, limiting in its language, in its articulation of what's really happening there. And I know you've spoken to me about your belief of it actually being more like a surplus. So it's really, like, truly not indicative of what's happening in our brains with labels like this.
Yeah, I think I've done a lot of thinking about how we do have a surplus of attention. And I actually feel like ADHD comes from a very colonialized perspective. So yes, there is definitely a patriarchal, capitalist, pathological agenda when you think about where these labels come from. And even though I'm really a big fan of getting diagnosed and getting clarity and also distinction around neurodiversity, you only really get to value a different type of brain by defining what it might look like. And we're using these terms as like a bridge to get us to where we want it to be totally in the future, which is why my whole organization is called Future ADHD. I want to bridge these things for people. But I've sort of lost my train of thought of where I was going, which is, again, something that happens a lot with ADHD.
This is the lived experience.
I was talking about like colonialism and just this idea that these terms have been sort of dumped on our doorstep by, honestly, a lot of straight, cis, white men who are starting to become very, you know, aged and expert in the industry, but they are on the way out. The door is open to them as they, like, finish their careers. And I think we're going to see a lot more diversity in terms of who is going to start speaking about neurodiversity. So we're going to see women, we're going to see all genders, we're going to see young folks, we're going to see Gen Z particularly, because they're already very vibrant and loud on TikTok. Yes. And that is, I think that's the new energy that this space needs, because, you know, all of these experts, I'm not going to like diss them, like Russell Barkley and William Dodson, like those sorts of people have definitely contributed. And I love ADHD 2.0 as well, which one of my favorite books.
Yeah, that's on my to-read list, I will say that. That's such a long to-read list. Well, and that's so much of the medical model itself, right, is coming from folks of that kind of presentation. And so I agree with you. I think that even when I'm thinking of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, you know, there's so much stigma in that, and it is created by these sort of medical model approach by these cishet white men. And so definitely a lot more work to be done around that. I think it was even like only the second most recent revision of the DSM took out like some really LGBTQ unfriendly terminology. And so, you know, there's a lot of work to do still with how we think about these things.
Mm. And I think it's an important conversation to just say ADHD is a label. It's a really empowering label. And I tend to just use it to find other people. I tend to use it to build a community because it's the label that makes sense right now and that has the most traction.
Yeah.
And then out of that, you start to have a sort of groundswell uprising of people who share the same brain-based differences, and we can kind of rename it together eventually.
When we talk about, like, you know, storytelling and sort of my approach to working with folks in the therapy room too, it's kind of that same idea of like a diagnosis can be a pathway, right? It shouldn't be a defining aspect of like how you view yourself necessarily. It doesn't have to be that, but it can certainly be a pathway to, like you said, community. It can be a pathway to understanding the next step for you in your healing journey or whatever that looks like. So that can be a really helpful reframe for how to view these things, but I'm totally in agreement with you. Yeah.
And on that note as well, I'd love to spend a little bit of time talking about the superpowers and the strengths of ADHD, the things that aren't in the label. And personally, when I got diagnosed, I felt like it was incredibly skewed towards the negative, towards the deficiencies in my brain and what I couldn't do. And there wasn't enough focus on actually all the wonderful things that my brain affords me and the ways that it makes me unique and distinctive. So what do you think some of those differences might be, Laura?
Well, I know, like, in my own lived experience, too, my biggest thing would be my enthusiasm. I just get so excited to learn new things, so excited to explore new things or new places, to kind of, like, totally immerse myself in learning about something new. And that's a really cool and exciting trait that I think my ADHD brain has helped me have and appreciate. Along those lines, too, I would say curiosity and creativity are really big ones that I see in a lot of folks that I work with, and a lot of my friends. A lot of my friends are also realizing that they might have this as well, and really learning about what makes their brains tick and what works for them. And even just taking that approach of, like, so knowing this about myself, I get to get creative with figuring out what works. I mean, you've created an entire planner that has taken, like, Etsy by storm, right? And that's creativity right there. That's inspiration and all of these really cool things that your brain has allowed you to do. So I'm with you on that it's hard. I think in general, it's really hard for humans not to focus on the negative. There's just something about our brains in general, like collectively that do that. But at the same time, focusing on those strengths and really figuring out, like, this makes me unique because I get feedback all the time that I'm just, like, a really enthusiastic and engaging person. And I 100% attribute that to my ADHD brain and kind of getting excited about so many different things at once.
Absolutely. And I feel as in your role as a therapist too, like the creativity and the curiosity and the energy that you bring into a space would immediately help people feel more at ease, more able to open up. And your curiosity would then help you really investigate what's going on for them and collaborate with them to work through their difficulties.
Yeah, that is feedback that I'm very fortunate to have gotten from many of my clients of just, okay, I feel safe here, right? And that comes from a genuine warmness and a genuine ability to, like, be excited and want to get to know them and want to create space for them. And yeah, like you said, have that curiosity to ask those questions. And so I've noticed in my work, that's definitely been a superpower. So as much as I could focus on, okay, well, I'm struggling to stay focused on writing things like my progress notes that I have to write after session, or on my social media, which is both a creative outlet and a nightmare to plan and manage. So I could focus on all of that, and I can focus more on this idea of, like, I get to be creative in this way. I get to show curiosity. I get to have these really cool conversations with people and really get to know people on this deeper level because my brain is allowing me to do that.
I love it. And I feel like certain industries would definitely attract the ADHD brain more than others. And I think therapy and teaching, which is what the industry I started in, definitely have a lot of people with ADHD in those industries.
Yeah. I mean, you said it earlier too, like the sense of community too, of us all sort of finding each other and realizing that we have this sort of shared experience. Maybe it looks different person to person, but we have this collective understanding. And some of the professions that you just named are kind of like community-based or just connection-based. And so I think connection is also a really big superpower that comes from having a brain that is geared towards ADHD. It's just that ability to sort of really get to know people and want to know about them and want to create space and stories with them.
Yeah, for sure. I would love to shift gears and go into a bit of a conversation around something that you touched on a little earlier. And I think it's a really key part of the ADHD diagnosis experience. And so that is the idea of, like, shame and negative self-concept and limiting beliefs and unhelpful narratives. And you've kind of spoken a bit with me in the past about self-compassion as being one of the crucial sort of first Yes. steps in alleviating that and starting to move through it. But also, I wondered if you had anything else to share around self-compassion and some other strategies that work.
Oh gosh, I could talk about self-compassion all day, but I will spare everybody.
Please do that.
What I will say about that is that's the gateway to so many other amazing and magical things that can happen. And so when I'm talking about self-compassion with folks, it's not about getting into a power struggle with yourself about, like, okay, my critical thoughts are telling me this, or my dominant story, my dominant narrative is telling me this, and I have to fight that. I think maybe that can be like a future goal, is to try to take over. But what I want to hone in on for folks, especially with ADHD, is, like, balance. It's okay to balance, to have space for both, you know, the feelings that are existing as they are and honoring those things, but also what's a more helpful, for one thing, and compassionate and kind narrative that you can say to yourself in conjunction with that, because that's how you build the resilience to be able to feel in control of your emotions. And as we know, emotion regulation can be a really big piece of ADHD for some folks. I know it is for how my ADHD presents. And so part of my emotional regulation has to include, okay, Laura, this doesn't mean that you are, you know, defective. This doesn't mean that you're too much. This doesn't mean all those things that your negative brain is telling you, right? That your anxious brain is telling you. This is just a moment. This is just a feeling, and it's going to pass, and that's okay. And I think, you know, this goes hand in hand too with like regulating our nervous system. And I'm sure we could have a whole sidebar conversation about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll definitely get to that because I actually had that down to talk with you about. So, but before we move on to that, I wanted to just, maybe ask, you know, if there is someone that's listening right now that's feeling like they're really struggling with a negative self-critic, and they know maybe intellectually that they shouldn't speak harshly to themselves. They know all of this, but it still happens. And I'm wondering if you feel that maybe having almost like a support person, an accountability buddy, like how do you kind of go about the process? I know it's a very big question, but in a nutshell, how do you go about the process of sort of like reparenting yourself and starting to show yourself self-compassion when it just feels so impossible at times?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this. I have a few thoughts on things that folks can actually take away from today and maybe try at home. The first one that I always say for folks who are struggling with like actually speaking to themselves, like their voice itself is just a negative critical voice and they don't know how to get out of that, would be to try and talk to yourself the way that you would talk to a loved one. So this could be your child, this could be your best friend, your partner, your mother, it could be, you know, whoever your most cherished loved one or loved ones are, and really imagine what you would say to them in the scenario. So if that person was coming to you saying some of the things that you're saying to yourself, would you tell them, yeah, you're being really stupid right now? I hope not, right? I hope that that's not the answer that you would give them. And so sometimes it's really hard to turn that same compassion inward. So it can be really helpful to pretend that we're talking to somebody else, to think what would this person say to me? And so it can be really helpful to externalize it in that way. And another strategy that's sort of similar would be to think about your inner child. And what does your inner child feel in this moment? What does your inner child need in this moment? And for folks who maybe aren't familiar with the concept of an inner child, you know, I'm of the belief that all of us have sort of this childlike part that still lives inside of us. And for some people who maybe have experienced trauma, that part can be wounded. For other folks, maybe that part's not wounded and then still comes out, you know, in a more innocuous way. But a lot of times our inner child can come out and is wounded and is reacting to what's happening in front of us the way that maybe we would have reacted as a child. And it can be these really big feelings. And so whenever we're thinking of working with children, we think of nurture, right? We think of compassion, we think of safety, we think of holding, we think of comforting, consoling. And so in those moments that you're talking harshly to yourself, what does your inner child feel about that? Do you want to be talking to your inner child that way? What's something that your inner child actually needs in this moment that you can provide to them? And so that's a lot of the reparenting work that I kind of do in the therapy room. It's like, when was our inner child wounded? What do they need? How can we nurture them? How can we nurture that? So that's another helpful strategy. And then the last thing I'll say is mindfulness. And I think for folks with ADHD, this can be a really difficult concept, especially because mindfulness can sound a lot like meditation a lot of the times. And I know I can't meditate. That's not something that really works for my brain. But being mindful can be a little bit different. Being mindful is sort of that space between like something happens that activates us or our nervous system or we get anxious, and then there's a reaction and response. And if we can take control of that space in between those two things and practice like calming down and being mindful through different soothing strategies or practicing self-talk or different strategies to get there, a lot of times we can feel more in control of the narrative.
I love that. Those are really important points to bring up. And as you're talking, I want to just reassure anyone who feels like, you know, frustrated at themselves that when they're hearing you speak and they're just feeling like, I just have never been able to do this. I feel like it's really a really far away goal. I would super encourage everyone to recognize the value of something like therapy to work through these things. So, you know, Laura works in Los Angeles. So if you're in Los Angeles, at the end of this interview, we'll mention where you can find Laura's work. And then if you're not, you know, within that sort of area and you want to find a therapist closer that might be able to help you, I think that it's worth saying that a lot of these negative self-perceptions and the negative self-critic is born over a whole lifetime. It's developed across a lifetime, and particularly in childhood. And a statistic that I often go back to is the stat that children with ADHD receive 20,000 negative messages by the time they are a teenager.
Wow, that's
in comparison to, I guess, in inverted commas, neurotypical children. And I'm thinking, you know, from my experience as a school teacher, when you have children in your class that are able to sit still and be quiet and respond when spoken to, those children don't receive as many negative messages. And when you have children with ADHD and other brain-based differences in your classroom that are climbing up the walls or interrupting other kids, and a lot of these traits are really positive, but in a school structured environment, there's no place for them because of the routine of the day and because the teacher's managing so many little people all at once. And so these small children can receive so many negative messages that confuse their inner child and really mean that in order to protect themselves across their life, they have an inner critic that comes in to sort of yell at them like a teacher or a parent might have done, to sort of say, get yourself together. And that's incredibly complicated to separate yourself from. And I think that therapy and inner child work and journaling, and I'd love to talk about some other modalities, but all of them don't happen in an instant. My journey with them has taken years and is taking years and will continue to take years. And I just want to really reassure people that this is not easy work, but it's definitely doable when you find the right support.
Yeah. And I mean, that goes hand in hand with why I found like your planner, for example, so helpful, is because it was created in mind as being that support system for folks with ADHD, right? And so when we think about like, oh, I've never been able to access these sort of resources, or I can't, you know, see myself being able to try some of these strategies, I just don't know how to do it, a lot of times it comes back to like, are you supported in this? And like, has there been anyone who's understood you or understood, you know, the things you've gone through, the experiences you've had with your ADHD? Because that's probably the first step, is to find someone who understands. And that, you know, could be a therapist who's well-versed in ADHD, and it could be other things too. But really reminding yourself that, you know, you can't, it takes a village a lot of the time. But I love what you said too, Grace, about just like that school structure and that inner child that gets all those negative messages. It's that was a really powerful statistic that you said, and it reminded me of one I read not that long ago of how a lot of kids with ADHD are, especially young boys who present with hyperactivity, get diagnosed with like oppositional defiant disorder or conduct disorder, which these are, like, for folks who don't know, behavior-based disorders that are typically viewed as like oppositional, defiant, not good kids. I'm putting these in quotation marks. And so when you think about like all of these kids that are being misdiagnosed in that sort of really stigmatizing and harsh way, how are they supposed to feel growing up?
Oh, absolutely. This was one of...
It's just so sad.
Yeah, this was one of my major issues as a teacher, and why I ended up leaving was that I felt that I couldn't support children because the system wasn't supportive of them, because I was working within a much bigger machine. And so as much as I tried to bring compassion, if I ever had a behavioral issue with a student, I knew that if I brought it to my supervisors, they would probably get a diagnosis. And the gravity of that is huge, I think, for a very young brain. And this is where diagnosis has probably got a bit out of hand, is that, you know, it's very easy to slap a label on particularly a child that's problematic within a system that can't handle that behavior and the diversity of behavior.
Yes.
And that's when a lot of children get diagnosed and then get saddled with this label for life, which actually just alienates them further and makes their behavior worse. And I'm a big believer as a parent in, and a lot of the research I've done on childhood development is that when kids feel better about themselves, they do better.
100%.
And back to the idea of the inner child, like, even if you're in your mid-20s, mid-30s, mid-40s, the same rule applies, is that when we feel better about ourselves, we do better. And I think that's a really key thing to mention in this whole discussion.
Yeah, when we're talking about different narratives, right, you were mentioning that these beliefs about self come from the lifespan, right? They start a lot of times in childhood from those messages that people might be getting in schools and whatnot, or in families. And what's happening is that all of those moments that this person is internalizing and remembering and, you know, assigning meaning to, those all get plotted on this like dominant storyline. And so suddenly we're even looking for examples that are going to confirm this belief that we have about ourselves, even if we don't want to believe that it's true. That's where shame can come in, right? I don't want to feel shame, but like I've been conditioned to feel shame my whole life. So of course, like I'm going to look out for it more because I'm going to be more sensitive to it. And so that's where, when we're talking about changing these narratives, I always ask my clients, not whether something's good or bad, but rather, is this helpful? Is this a helpful train of thought for you? Because ultimately something could be like truly negative or not an exciting or fun thing, but there's still maybe different ways to think about that are more helpful than others, right? Is this going to kick you while you're down and like you said, not perform well or not do well? Or is there a thought process, maybe a reframe we can offer ourselves that's more compassionate and ultimately more helpful and not drawing us further away from our values?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to also ask you, Laura, while we're talking about different therapies and different strategies that might work, in your experience, alongside just the sort of more traditional talk therapy, are there other modalities that you feel really work for the ADHD experience in sort of starting to peel back some of the layers?
Yeah, definitely. So in my work, I incorporate EMDR. For folks who aren't familiar, that's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. It's a mouthful. And I like this modality a lot, especially for we're talking about ADHD, because it really targets shame and trauma. So EMDR was created as a trauma therapy, and it's been expanded to include, you know, kind of higher tier anxiety, but it really helps to target shame and the beliefs we hold about ourselves or the beliefs we hold about the world. Maybe we believe the world's not safe because of something we've experienced. So it takes these really raw, vulnerable, like scary belief systems that can cause really difficult symptoms for some folks. And through eye movement, bilateral stimulation, or other kinds of bilateral stimulation, it actually helps to reprogram the brain in such a way that I like to think of it as something gets filed from the incorrect filing cabinet into the more correct filing cabinet so that it's not as distressing or disturbing in your life. And so, you know, when we're talking about rejection sensitivity and shame and these beliefs about self that are, you know, just kind of repeated all throughout the lifespan, this can be a really healing modality for folks that struggle with those kinds of things. I would say also, like I said, I do a lot of narrative therapy and inner child work, and those are really great ones because, again, they can target what's the meaning I've created about my life or myself? What's the value I've placed on myself? What's the story I believe about myself? And so anything that can really challenge those harmful narratives and give you the power back to create your own story, I think is really, really healing for folks with ADHD.
I love what you said about creating your own story. And if anything springs to mind around, like, what is an example, say, of a problem that a client of yours might come in with, and you kind of either use EMDR or narrative therapy or a combination of those, what might be the results? Like, and obviously it might take a few weeks or many months, like it's not going to happen overnight, but what sort of problem and solution could be found?
Yeah. So one thing I've noticed, especially for the folks that I see that have ADHD, is that they don't often come to me initially for ADHD. They come to me for things like, I get a lot of like high functioning anxiety folks or people who come from family structures with really high expectations or perfectionism tendencies. And then again, it's that perpetuated shame of like, why don't I measure up to the rest of my family? Or why don't I feel like I'm adequate within my family dynamics? So I do a lot of work around sort of like family of origin trauma. And then we tease out sort of where this anxiety is coming from. And for a lot of clients, a big part of that is ADHD that really hasn't been addressed or nurtured or, you know, even like thought of as a possible thing that they might be dealing with. And so for someone who's coming in like that, we might start with some basic kind of CBT just to get a sense of like their existing narratives. We might build some coping skills to see where they're at with that. And then we might dive into the deep work. And so I would, if I was using EMDR, I would target with someone like, what is the belief about yourself that is really holding you back? And so through that bilateral stimulation, we figure out like, what's the core memory or maybe multiple memories that feed into that belief, that narrative? And so through healing those specific memories or incidents or experiences that they've had, then we get to understand like, oh, I don't have to believe this about myself. And it can be really, really powerful.
So I'm hearing that basically all of us have these brains and these sort of programming set up in our brains with neural pathways and memories that go way back into childhood. And yes, most of the time, in fact, I think my belief is that all of the time we're unaware that these programs are running in our brain. And it's only when you start to investigate patterns across, you know, recent times where you feel like this is triggering me, you sort of can take that as almost like an invitation to explore what might be the unconscious programming beneath the surface. And EMDR maybe do you want to share a little bit more, Laura, for people who don't understand or haven't really heard of bilateral stimulation? Like, that is it's a very non-cognitive, well, it is cognitive, but what I'm more so meaning is that I can imagine, I haven't done it myself, but I can imagine that my brain is pretty clever. And if I do talk therapy, it can pretty much always find a reason to not believe the therapist or to, you know, to just straight up put up a wall. But is bilateral stimulation almost a way of almost sidestepping that automatic neural pathway in the brain?
Yeah. So what I would say is I just also want to caution everyone that of course not every modality is going to work for everybody. So I don't want to propose EMDR as like a super, this is going to heal everything kind of a solution, because it may not work for folks. But I will say that one of the powerful things about it is that it's really targeting different parts of your brain. And so in talk therapy, like you said, it's a little bit more of a awareness and cognitive process. And so what I find to be the biggest challenge sometimes with folks with doing traditional cognitive behavioral therapy or other type of talk therapies is that, like, I think you had actually mentioned something like this earlier, that intellectually your logical brain might be aware that something is what it is, but then your emotional brain struggles to accept that or struggles to believe it, right? And that's the part that is full of shame. That's the inner child. That's the stories that we've been carrying with us throughout our whole lives that have told us we're not good enough or whatever those stories are. So there's this imbalance between the intellectual logical brain and the emotional brain, and a lot of people get stuck there. So EMDR can help with that, because what happens is your brain takes you where you need to go. And sometimes there's different blocking beliefs that can get in the way, and we would target those individually if we need to in a EMDR session. But it's nice because you don't have to sort of retell your story in a oral way or a verbal way. You don't have to sort of think too hard on it's not really insight based, I suppose. It's a lot more of that brain process, and your brain will sort of guide you where you need to go. I've done many EMDR sessions where we started kind of targeting one thing and we ended up discovering like a memory that wasn't even on their radar, but that was where we needed to go. So it's just a different approach. I would say that they're you know, that what works for a lot of my clients is kind of integrating multiple different things together. But yeah, it can be really different from what most people have tried.
Yeah, thank you for sharing more about that. I just wanted to really double down on that, because I feel like some of these things get mentioned and people, you know, don't have the chance to really understand what they might mean. Like, so it's good to actually talk about the unconscious side of it. And I also want to mention, I have done a bit of a deep dive with an internal family systems therapist. So that's commonly called IFS. Yeah. And there are actual therapists that specialize in IFS. It's a particular type of training that you need to do. And that is a very structured investigative approach into your inner child. And the way that it's helped me, without going obviously too much into detail, but it's by following those triggers inside and letting your internal system and your natural parts that operate in your brain, you might have parts that are in direct opposition to each other. I like to also say it's a lot like the movie Inside Out, where they show those five parts yeah. in the brain, those five personalities. And in fact, we all have, you know, scores like, you know, 10, 20, 30 sometimes of these parts all piping up at different times, and they all have different agendas. And so I have found IFS really helpful in, as you said, Laura, exactly the same, is getting to this core memory that I didn't even know had such a powerful, underpinning agenda in that would show up yeah. in my behavior, but I'd have no idea that there was this core wound or this inner child that had received this message about themselves and carried this belief all through life. And it was really limiting me.
Yeah. And once you unlock that, like, I've heard from a lot of clients, like, I can't believe that I'm holding on to this, like, seemingly stupid or innocuous thing. Like, why does this have such an impact? And obviously, that's very shame-based language. And so we work on the compassion with that. But it's that idea that, like, well, you know, I can't believe something that I didn't even have on my radar, that I didn't even realize was a big core piece of this, has impacted me so much. But once you kind of unlock that, you're able to heal it. And that's what we're doing. Because when we think of any type of experience that's caused us pain, any of that can be considered trauma, right? It doesn't have to be a big T trauma to be traumatic for us. It just has to be something that has changed maybe our view of self or changed how we experience the world. And I think for a lot of folks with ADHD, those shame-based stories can count as traumatic experiences that shape the way that they move throughout the world and how they interact with other people. And so healing those parts, healing that wounded inner child, healing those core memories that maybe have been unresolved all these years, whatever it might be, you get to then experience freedom of not feeling stigmatized, not feeling all of these shameful things that you've been carrying with you. And you get to, again, integrate that into writing your own story and reauthoring that story for yourself.
Yeah, amazing. I 100% agree with all of that. And before we finish up, Laura, because it's been so beautiful chatting to you, I sort of have one more area that we touched on earlier, and I wanted to just circle back around to it while I have you here. So I talk a lot about nervous system nourishment, and yes. I've found that because I'm a combined type ADHD and have a strong hyperactivity, you know, traits running through my ADHD, and that's, you know, quite different to, I guess, those who would be diagnosed more inattentive. They don't have as much of the hyperactive. So I wanted to just also mention that there is a broad spectrum of how it shows up. But for me, I have really strong hyperactivity and my nervous system runs quite hot and intense a lot of the time. And so I use strategies like breath work and sound therapy to slow down my racing driven nervous system. And I'm very similar to you in that meditation doesn't really help, but I found these other modalities that have really helped, because if I stick on some sound, it's like I'm not forced to have to clear my mind. It's actually just that my mind starts to hyper-focus on the sounds that I'm hearing, and that can kind of pull me into a more embodied state and to really start to slow down my nervous system and calm it down and down-regulate it. So I wanted to hear, I guess, what are your thoughts about nervous system nourishment, or whatever you might like to call it, and polyvagal theory and all of those good things?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that could be a whole other sidebar, right? Well, I think the nervous system explains so much. Once we learn about how it works and why certain things activated and what our triggers look like, that's so much information for us. And so we were just talking about how some of these things can be considered traumatic experiences or really, you know, transformative experiences, in that they change the way we view ourselves or view the world. And that comes back down to nervous system. Because if you're having an experience that's reminding you of this traumatic thing that you experience as a child, or, you know, maybe some of the shame messages that you receive from teachers or whatever it might be, your nervous system doesn't know that you're not in that situation right here and now. Your nervous system just knows that it feels threatened the way that it did then, or it feels unsafe the way that it did then. And so it's so important to, I would say, individually understand, like, when it starts to feel like your nervous system is dysregulated. So it sounds like you have a really good understanding of like when your body doesn't feel calm, and like you said, you feel maybe disembodied, and I that's something that I experience as well. It's like, okay, wait, all of a sudden I'm noticing I feel kind of like hot and I feel kind of intense, and that's my cue that like, oh, my nervous system's dysregulated. And so you know, one of the things that I really love to help with that, I agree with breath work 1000%. That's probably the starting place I would give to most folks, because there's such power in regulating your breathing, and there can be this really therapeutic rhythm to regulating your breathing. And I know a lot of folks sometimes struggle with deep breathing, but there's ways to do it where you really are intentionally focused on, okay, how many seconds am I going to breathe in? How many seconds am I going to hold for or exhale? And that experience not only distracts you from what's happening around you, but it really does slow down your body, your physiology. So that's one thing. Another thing I would say is anything that can kind of change your body chemistry in that moment. And so in dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, there's this acronym called TIP. And this is a really great tool to use for regulating your just your body chemistry. And so basically TIP stands for temperature, intense exercise, paced breathing, and progressive muscle relaxation. And these are just kind of physiological tools that you can use to calm down your nervous system. It changes your body chemistry. So for example, for temperature, if you're feeling really dysregulated, if your nervous system is feeling really hyperactive or really unsettled, you can, you know, rush cold water over your hands. Or you can do something that incorporates like your body or your five senses, and that will help. Intense exercise isn't always possible in every situation, but even if you can do something that's just like changing your body chemistry, maybe it's through use of smell, like essential oils, maybe it's through use of taste. So I always go to those sort of like somatic resources that we have. Right now, I'm sitting here with a blanket on my lap, and it's a soft blanket. And so I've been, you know, throughout this interview, kind of just like touching this blanket, because sometimes I get nervous with public speaking, right? And so that helps to soothe me. So anything that you can use as a resource that helps your body chemistry or keeps you grounded in the present, I would say would be really good nervous system soothing resources.
Oh, I love how practical all of those suggestions are. And I love that while there is, you know, an array of things, I mean, I know that even yoga can help people, and yes, there is, you know, taking a cold swim in the ocean, like there are so many things, right? But I think the important point is that there are so many things, and it's almost like an invitation steeped in hope. Like there are so many things that we can try, and each of us have very differently wired nervous systems. And so just experimenting, almost being like a little scientist and thinking, okay, what does my nervous system need in this moment? And you can almost write down a menu for yourself and stick it on your fridge. You know, I have some pages like that in the planner, but obviously there is so much more I could say and share about it. I also have a bunch of self-care resources on my website that speak to this. And then there are loads of resources out there online as well. And so just based out of what we've chatted through today, Laura, like people can go and start to look into some of these strategies, write them down, and then just try them out. If they're feeling anxious, running their hands under cold water, if they can't get out, you know, for a walk or for a swim in the ocean, like there are so many things that can redirect our brain in moments of stress.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's really the key. I'm glad you phrased it that way, because I think so often as humans, sometimes our goal is to avoid discomfort, and that's not going to happen all the time, especially with ADHD, right? And so sometimes we have to refocus our goal into how do I get through this moment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point. And it really does bring up the concept for me of resilience. Like resilience is learning to experience tough emotions in your body and to still feel like yourself as you're going through that really difficult emotion, and to be able to have the nervous system capacity to hold it. And so it's like a muscle at the gym. I always like to think of it this way for myself, is that if you feel like this is sounding daunting, well, it's totally normal to feel that way. And if you practice some of these things over time, you will build up muscles and get stronger when it comes to processing tough feelings and taking yourself through tough emotions.
That's so funny because that's literally how I describe it to folks every day at work. It's like, okay, we're working our brain the same way we would work different muscle groups in the gym, and we have to have a starting point, and this is our starting point.
Yeah, and I think that journey aspect to it, that sort of likening it to something like going to the gym, everyone can understand that you start off and your muscles aren't toned and you don't really know which exercises to do and you feel like a bit of a, you know, a goof.
Yeah.
But if you do it with someone like a therapist, like a coach, you know, ADHD coach, are also really great resources. They can guide you through, and there is a pathway through, and there is hope, essentially, you know, because there is so much knowledge out there now. And as more people start to talk about ADHD and neurodiversity, the resources are only going to improve and get better and better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Laura, I just feel so full of joy and gratitude for our chat today. I feel like it has been a really helpful and important resource for people who are on this journey. And I also feel that we could keep talking all day because we haven't covered heaps of stuff. So I would love to have you back for a second round down the track because, you know, there is so much more we could talk about. But I would love to finish up by just asking you, where can people find out more about you and your work? And if, what are your parameters for who you can work with? I know that, you know, that it might be based in California, or if someone wanted to work with you, how could they do that?
Yeah, so I'm licensed in the state of California, so I can see folks all across the state. I do provide virtual therapy, so you don't have to live in the Los Angeles area, which is great. So if anyone is looking for a therapist in California, you can find me at www.laurascrowlcsw.com. I also have an Instagram account, laurascrowlcsw, where I post mental health content, different resources, coping tools, educational tidbits and different things all related to mental health, anxiety, ADHD, trauma, those kinds of things. And so that's a resource that anyone can access regardless of where you are.
Amazing. And we will put the links to Laura's website and her Instagram in the show notes for this episode. And also we will link everything we've talked about, the different therapy modalities. I'll get you to provide some resource links if that's okay, Laura. And I'll also look for some myself. And then that way we can create sort of like a resource library for people if they want to do a deep dive off the back of this episode.
Yeah.
And I'll also mention that Laura mentioned her Instagram, and I'll say that it's definitely go and check it out. I love Laura's Instagram. She has a beautiful energy. She's really creative. Surprise, surprise. She has ADHD, so she's very creative. And it's just a really beautiful space you've created there, Laura. So
thanks, Grace.
You're welcome. So thank you so much for spending the time with me today. And I hope you have a beautiful rest of your evening over there in California. It's morning here for me in Australia.
Yeah.
And we will chat again soon. But thank you so much for today. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me, Grace. And thank you to everyone who's listening. I hope it's been helpful.
Thanks so much for joining me for today's episode. And if you're keen for more, we have a lot of free resources on our website, futureadhd.com, where you can also buy our planners and support tools. Our Future ADHD planners are based on the latest neuroscience and have a unique build-as-you-go format, which makes them different to your average planner. This feature makes it ridiculously easy to pick up where you left off, even if you miss weeks or months at a time, without the shame spirals, guilt, or critical self-talk. Our digital version works with iPads, iPhones, Android tablets and Android phones, Windows and Macs. We also have a printable version for those who love paper and pen. Join almost 20,000 neurodivergents who have downloaded our planners and say that this is the first planner they've ever been able to stick with, because it's designed to work with your creative, inconsistent, divergent, non-linear brain. And if you want to watch a planner walkthrough or learn more about Future ADHD and our mission, check out our Instagram and TikTok, future.adhd, and of course our website, futureadhd.com.